From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. News media outlets have enjoyed a long-standing exemption from campaign finance laws. We'll hear from an expert who wants that same exemption extended to civic and social groups that also inform the public. North Carolina lawmakers continue to search for a long-term alternative to the state gas tax. They heard advice recently from a national group representing state highway officials. Legislators also heard a recent update on bond-funded building projects at UNC campuses. You hear their concerns about costs. Plus, we'll learn why an advocate for North Carolina's public charter schools believes the charter school movement might be too complacent. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Imagine owning 600 acres of waterfront property in Southport, North Carolina. Sounds pretty good, right? Well, that is the case for the state of North Carolina. In 2006, the State Ports Authority bought the land for $30 million and then set it aside for something called a megaport. But so far, no megaport, just vacant land. Carolina Journal Editor-in-Chief Rick Henderson joins us now with the story, which you can read at carolinajournal.com, written by Don Carrington. Welcome back to the show, Rick.
Thank you, Donna.
First of all, in terms of the ports, we know about the port of Wilmington. We know about the port at Morehead City. What's a megaport?
The megaport was supposed to be a project that could handle even larger amounts of freight and cargo than the existing ports, and also something that could handle, let's say, double-decker trains and things like that. So it could handle it could really transport much, much larger individual shipments than the existing ports. And that the idea was to build one here to handle new cargo coming from the Panama Canal, which of course was now had been widened and deepened, and you know had been able to handle larger carriers than before.
The operative word that you just used was idea.
Right.
Apparently, this was an idea more than 10 years ago, and then in 2006, the Ports Authority bought the land, but there must be some sort of, what, approved plan or something?
Well, there wasn't a study, feasibility study done, for one thing, to see if this was an appropriate site for a megaport. It's just that the state saw this property and said, we want it, and they got it. And the idea that the Ports Authority had was we're going to make this the supreme cargo shipping terminal in between New York and Florida. And that was the idea, because Morehead City and Wilmington really aren't appropriate for that purpose. There's been talk about that. But as it turns out, those ports weren't right. For one thing, there's a lot of population there that there's not necessarily at Southport. And there are other sort of logistical issues with that. But Morehead City, Southport, as it turns out, wasn't a good site either. But the state really didn't worry about that. They just went ahead and bought the land.
So they paid $30 million
right.
for it in 2006 and then went forward with trying to get some sort of plan approved.
Correct.
And there were problems.
Yes, there were a lot of problems with it. The main problem was that this land was adjacent to the Brunswick nuclear plant that Duke Progress Energy now operates. And the issue with that is that the rail lines that would be needed to transport cargo from the port to the mainland and then from there to trucking centers and things like that, that rail line would have to go through the main escape area, evacuation area of the nuclear plant. So if
Not
there was
good.
No, and the average or the typical train taking cargo from the port would be a mile long. So this was a big issue.
A hazard.
This was a hazard. Well, it turns out that Don Carrington, who did the story for us originally back, I believe, in 2012, was someone who was an economic developer for Progress Energy's predecessor, Carolina Power and Light, back at the time that they were first purchasing the land around the Brunswick nuclear plant. So he actually was looking into this and knew at the time that the nuclear plant, once it was established, would have all sorts of restrictions on what sort of other industrial properties could be around there. And one of them would be something that would possibly clog the rail lines there. And you can't do that if you're going to need to possibly transport in emergency equipment and things like that if there were some sort of trouble at the plant itself.
So the nuke plant becomes an issue, but also folks in Southport didn't really like this idea either. I mean, it's a beautiful community and right. lots of tourism there, a lot of retirees, and apparently they were pretty vocal about this.
Yeah, they really were. There was a lot of local opposition to this. The local legislative delegation, for the most part, was strongly opposed to it. There were some people who were on the fence, but then later turned against it. The congressional delegation didn't particularly like it either. In fact, the congressional delegation would have been involved in some extent to providing some sort of federal funding or federal waivers from environmental regulations to make it happen, and they weren't really all keen on it because they, I think, understood the possible risks. But for some reason, folks, the State Ports Authority didn't, and so they went ahead with plans to do so. This was something that Governor Mike Easley was really, really high on doing, and even though he lives in Southport, but it just did not come together, and so the state ended up abandoning it after, for one thing, as a result in part of Carolina Journal's reporting about the strong local opposition and the previously, heretofore unreported, problem with the nuclear plant there.
Rick, this whole thing sounds like a classic case of putting the cart before the horse. You buy the land for $30 million, and then you start discovering that there are issues and challenges to the megaport you wanted to build?
Right, and that's been a problem with an awful lot of economic development projects North Carolina has done. If we've tried to be a pioneer in something, sometimes being an early adopter is not a good idea, and we've found that out with the Global Trans Park. We've certainly discovered it with the Randy Parton Theater, but there are all sorts of other economic development issues like that. If you're trying to do something no one has done before, sometimes there's a reason no one's done it before is because they figured out it wouldn't work. And this was one of those examples in which you tried to place this massive cargo facility. If you've ever been around, say, Long Beach, California or San Pedro or someplace mm-hmm. like that, I mean, this is not a quiet area. This is an area where there's going to be an incredible amount of activity, a lot of noise, potentially a lot of pollution and other things like that. And the folks in Southport said, no, we don't want to live there. We didn't buy into that when we got here.
Once this idea went south, why didn't the state sell the land?
That's a real good question. The state has not sold the land. There are apparently no plans to sell the land. Some of the local folks there who opposed the port think that the state's going to try to revive it at some point. They may think that somebody in the Cooper administration might be interested in doing that. There's no indication that that's the case either. But the interesting thing is that when there was apparently there must have been a party who was interested in purchasing the land because an appraisal of the land was done in 2013, and the appraisal said that the land came in at $15.2 million, which is half of what the state paid for it. Plus, the state also has paid $10 million in preparation for the port, and you've got the cost of borrowing money, so the amount of debt service that was done to purchase this land. So this is basically $50 million boondoggle the state's sitting on right now that it might get 30 cents on the dollar for.
Oh my gosh, that's just incredible. So what are the options then? And perhaps most importantly, are state legislators or state officials that are running the Ports Authority, are they concerned that they've got this piece of land that keeps losing value?
Well, they have been pretty quiet about it so far. There may well be some renewed interest in doing something about it. I think what's of interest is that a couple of the members of the state legislative delegation who were either mildly supporting the idea of a megaport or who were on the fence about it have now turned against it. And so what they may well do is to force some sort of fire sale, even if the state loses money, just to get it off the books, to get it on the tax rolls, because it's not on the tax rolls now since the state owns it, and at least to minimize losses. And so that may be the next move. But we'll see what happens. I mean, part of that has to be the Council of State has to get involved if that's a property transaction. And we'll see what happens if the General Assembly makes an issue of it and if the Council of State gets involved.
So maybe this 600-acre parcel of land will join up with that state helicopter that the state is trying to sell. And as the time you and I are talking, apparently the legislature has told them, look, you got to kind of get on the stick and sell this helicopter
right.
that we're not using.
Right.
So it's not unprecedented that the state would be in a position of having some sort of asset that they need to get rid of,
right.
find a buyer for.
Or if nothing else, they could always do something with it, like donate to the Nature Conservancy or some such thing. If they're not going to get any money for it at all, or if they're going to take a heavy loss on it, there are other things that could possibly be done.
Well, it's an amazing story, and you can read it at carolinajournal.com. It's written by Don Carrington. Failed Megaport site still vacant and is losing value. We've been talking with Rick Henderson, who is editor-in-chief. Rick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at carolinajournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. News media outlets have long enjoyed exemptions from federal and state campaign finance laws. The same cannot be said for nonprofit, social, and civic groups that play a similar role of informing the public. But our next guest thinks all of these groups should get the same type of treatment. John Riches is Director of National Litigation for the Goldwater Institute's Scharf Norton Center for Constitutional Litigation. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Mitch.
So we know, if we've followed how campaign finance laws work, that typically the news media outlets, newspapers, TV, radio, all of those news media outlets get exempted. No one says you can't say this or report that because they're news media. But you're drawing attention to the fact that other groups that play a similar role get very different treatment.
Yeah, and it's important to understand kind of the scope of the problem at the outset. What we're seeing throughout the country is demands that what are called 501c3 organizations, which are your traditional nonprofit organizations, they can be something like a neighborhood church, they can be a soup kitchen, but they could also be civic organizations or policy organizations. And these range ideologically from the NRA to the ACLU to you name it. And oftentimes, they speak about policy matters. This policy is good for these reasons. This policy is bad for those reasons. Now, there are specific statutory exemptions that say when the news media speaks about issues, they're exempt from campaign finance restrictions. They're exempt from what are called donor disclosure mandates. The same is not true for when a small nonprofit might speak about the very same issue. We are seeing increasingly at the state and local level, and in some cases there's been federal legislation introduced as well, that's requiring private donors to these nonprofit organizations that speak on policy issues to report their names and their addresses to the government, while the media is enjoying broad exemptions from those requirements.
Why is that a problem?
Well, there's really two reasons. There's the principled case and then there's the practical case. The principled case is that, look, when we're talking about public policy organizations, their whole purpose is to communicate with the public. Their whole purpose is to collect information, to analyze it, and then to disseminate it. The news media fills a functionally equivalent role. Their purpose is to collect and disseminate information. And in fact, going back to our history, one of the things that impressed de Tocqueville most about our democracy was robust associations that could get together and talk about issues that were important to them. And when the law exempts one group or treats one group, in this case the institutional press, differently from a group that fills just as important of a role and a functionally equivalent role, that's a problem. That's a problem from equal protection grounds, and that's just simply that's a problem in our Republican government. Because of course, what we see is the more of these barriers that are put up, the less communication we get, the less free speech we get. There's also a practical problem. I mean, it's no surprise to you that the media is changing. What differentiates a very popular Twitter feed or blog post from more traditional institutional press. And at some point, as the Supreme Court has kind of made overtures, it's going to be hard to draw those lines. So we should all recognize that the way people receive information is changing, and the law shouldn't treat those sources of information differently.
That is the voice of John Riches. He is director of national litigation for the Goldwater Institute based in Arizona. Some people might hear us and say, okay, I could see treating all the groups the same. So how about no exemption for anyone and everyone has to tell us who their donors are? Why would that not be the right way to go?
We want people to receive information as freely as possible and to be able to communicate information as freely as possible. So the media exemption that exists in these laws, I mean, it's a good thing, right? We want a free press. We want the ability of people to talk to one another. That exemption should be broadened rather than restricted. And it should be broadened to recognize that there's other organizations that fulfill just as important of a role as the institutional press. And it's really, frankly, it's a fundamental part of our republic to have these sorts of associations, and they shouldn't be impeded by the law.
If these groups that are playing a role in disseminating information about policy are forced to disclose their donors, or if for some reason someone said, well, you know, we should do this to the media as well, get rid of their exemption, what sort of effect would this have on our public policy debates? I suspect there might be some sort of chilling effect.
For sure. There's a few reasons for that. The most troubling is that what we've seen in some of these states that have enacted donor disclosure mandates is retaliation. We see donors to private organizations or causes lose their jobs, be threatened. This happened with Prop 8 in California. It's happened throughout the country with a number of controversial issues. And as you say, there's an additional chilling effect besides just the fear of retaliation. I mean, look, every American should be able to support the causes they believe in without having to worry about retaliation. But oftentimes, these laws are so complex, no one really knows what's prohibited and what's permissible. And as a result, fewer people speak. We had a law out in Arizona where they defined a political committee in a 183-word run-on sentence. A judge ended up striking that down and saying not even a campaign finance lawyer could figure out what is and what isn't a political committee subject to these onerous campaign finance restrictions. And of course, if no one really understands what's allowed, fewer people are probably going to participate, and that's a problem for all of us.
Sounds like the judge might have been relying on the bad grammar precedent or something of that sort. When we have all of these organizations able to compete on a level playing field in terms of not having to disclose donors and having the traditional news media and the newer media or information sources treated the same, how's that going to benefit our society from your vantage point?
Well, people then know what the rules of the road are. They're clear. And when we talk about the First Amendment, when we talk about free speech, that's the goal we have to aspire to. People have to know this is going to be allowed. I am not going to be treated differently or unfairly. And when that happens, we get more speech. And when we talk just more directly about why do those who support nonprofit organizations do so, for a variety of reasons, and oftentimes they want to support those organizations privately. Maybe they have religious reasons for giving privately. Maybe they don't want to be harassed by other charitable organizations looking to see their other donations, and they'll solicit them for additional funds. So we have a more robust civic society when we have fewer restraints placed on speech and on private giving.
I imagine many of the people listening to us will agree, at least in principle, but some might be saying, yeah, but what about those people in the shadows, the big money interests who are helping to support these causes? Shouldn't we know that these people are behind these various information sources? What would be your response when someone says, what about them?
Sure. My initial response is that we already do for the most part. I mean, there is an enormous amount of reporting requirements when we talk about campaign finance. And here's an important distinction. When we talk about contributions to political candidates, those are all disclosed above a very, very low dollar amount. If someone supports or opposes anybody running for an election, we know who that is. When we're talking about nonprofit organizations, that's an entirely different situation. And the reason is under federal law, 501c3 nonprofits are prohibited from engaging in politics. They're pure issue advocacy groups, right?
Well, it's a very interesting topic, and one person who's going to be keeping on top of it is John Riches. He is Director of National Litigation for the Goldwater Institute's Scharf Norton Center for Constitutional Litigation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers continue to look for a long-term alternative to the state gas tax. They heard ideas recently from Jung Lee. He's policy director for the American Association of State Highway Transportation Officials, otherwise known as ASHTO.
Eight states were awarded the first tranche of the seed money to explore different ideas. A lot of them looking at this idea of vehicle miles travel fee as the successor to the fuel tax. I would say probably the one that has gone the furthest on the vehicle miles travel fee effort is the state of Oregon. They've actually been at it now for more than a decade, starting out with a pilot program, and now they do have this legislatively enacted permanent program for up to 5,000 drivers. California is also looking at a 10,000 person or driver pilot right now, Washington State. So that whole corridor out west is really far down the VMT route.
Some states are looking at tolling of interstate highways. Lee admits that's a controversial option. He says there are other ideas.
54 state revenue sources have been identified that range far beyond the fuel tax or the tolling. You're talking about oil company taxes, you're talking about land sales, you're talking about even gambling revenues sometimes have been known to be used for transportation purposes. So states recognize where the needs are or how important the transportation investment needs are and are willing to consider a lot of different options and ideas to get there.
Lee offered lawmakers some final advice.
The key here when it comes to the transportation revenue conversation is being able to make that value proposition to the public that are using the system every day. This is a great example, I think. When you ask a typical person on the street an interview, which we did a video a few years ago, how much does a typical person, typical driver pay in gas tax, both federal and state, per year basis? This guy, a very nice seeming guy, works at an auto repair shop, says $6,000-$7,000 a year. Others in the video said $2,000-$3,000. It comes out to about $300 per year. So when you look at it on a monthly basis, it's actually less than, you know, your cell phone, your cable, your other types of utility bills, and especially compared to cable. I would think that, you know, being able to access our transportation infrastructure is pretty darn important, and it's a great value proposition. And so I think, you know, from the transportation industry, what we need to do a better job of is being able to communicate just the clarity of, you know, this is the value that we propose to you in exchange for the contributions that we're asking you to provide.
That's Jung Lee of the American Association of State Highway Transportation Officials. He's offering North Carolina lawmakers ideas about alternatives to the state gas tax. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. North Carolina lawmakers recently heard an update on the nearly $1 billion voters approved for new construction projects throughout the University of North Carolina system. Will Johnson is an associate vice president for the university.
The trend is definitely up on our construction costs through the middle of 2017. Bottom line is we're seeing about a 5% increase a year on construction costs. Those numbers are debatable. They're up and down. They're in and out. All of our bond projects, average construction costs for all of our 21 projects, just short of $400 a square foot for a lot of these STEM buildings. These are all of our bond projects. The light blue gray are renovations. If you go to our new construction projects, the average is about $460 a square foot. Above that average line from left to right, you'll see the asterisk above those columns. That's the buildings that have intensive research functions in them. Intensive research functions in them. Not just wet labs, not just black resin tops. We're talking about cutting edge research. We're talking about HVAC systems that for BSL-3 laboratories that you have to provide negative pressure to those labs or positive pressure, as the case may be, that requires a separate and distinct entire HVAC system with an entire floor added in square footage to support that.
Johnson compiled 20 minutes worth of data, but Democratic State Senator Joel Ford of Mecklenburg County focused on one particular figure.
I'm going to bring you back to the cost per square foot. Have you been able to, you or your staff, been able to identify any variances as the reason why we've got this such variance in cost in construction from these various universities across the system?
We are looking at that. We have looked at that, and we're talking to the campuses and their design and construction teams about those numbers. It goes to kind of a basic question across the board. Why can't we just tell a campus that you've got $300 a square foot and that's what you get? And for NC State, you want a plant science building, you have $300 a square foot and that's what you get. These buildings are markedly different from each other. A business school is nothing like a plant science building, and when the function of these buildings is a priority for the campus, they go look at the external comparable buildings. So NC State for plant science buildings, they went to 7 or 8 places around the country. They went to Bayer at RTP, there's San Diego, there was Phoenix, there's the Genome Science Building at Chapel Hill that came on board in 2012, I believe. And you look at what research that the academics are saying that's going to be the cutting edge. Again, we're back to our try to forecast a decade in advance. And they looked at those buildings. And when you have Greenhouse and BSL-3 laboratories, and this is where your research is taking you at NC State for that one building, the average cost per square foot for all those 7 or 8 buildings was $630 a square foot. So NC State right now, their budget is $628. So each building has its own story of what the campuses would like to have within the bond. The dollars that were assigned to those campus priorities were in most cases a lot less than what the campuses had identified early on.
Ford responded.
It's a little disappointing because this is not the state's first bond program. And I would have liked to have seen the state and staff identify some consistencies as it relates to cost savings for construction going forward. And I understand difference cost in construction from one type of building from another, but a life science building at NC State should not be different from a life science building at NC&T. Both of those engineering buildings, sir, quite frankly, should have drywall in it. Both of those buildings, if they're made out of brick, brick is brick. And my point is, how can the administration help the system gain leverage and at a minimum in buying power, right? And so all these buildings are going to have some form, whether it's going to be a metal or wood studs. I'm just looking to hear something different going forward in terms of how can the state save money by leveraging $2 billion so that we can build the buildings that these universities want to build, but save money while doing it.
Ford wasn't the only one who mentioned the costs of a basic building material, brick. Republican State Representative Dean Arp used bricks to make a larger point about building quality.
How do we determine what your input for quality has been to address? Not just cutting the size of the building because we want, you know, the most that we can get. How do we determine what was done from a cost standpoint, a quality standpoint? And when I say quality, I'm talking about you can have brick, but you can have a $50 brick or a $10 brick. You know, that's the thing I'm talking about.
There are different bricks, and people do use different types of bricks. And those things are tied to what style the campuses are in. NC State has a standard range of colored bricks, and they have a standard color additive to their mortar. That's what NC State is. And that colored mortar costs a little bit more than our standard gray mortar.
The discussion didn't end with expensive, specially colored bricks. Republican State Representative John Hardister focused on the overall cost of new construction projects.
$460 a square foot just seems kind of high to me. And I've worked in real estate, and I've worked in mostly residential. Commercial can be more expensive. If you're looking at retail, if you're looking at commercial, residential, construction, I think the most expensive projects are usually medical facilities. So I'm doing some research here, and I'm looking at design cost data. I'm looking at their website, and when I look at the cost of medical centers, we're talking about cardiology centers, $316 a square foot, $183 a square foot, cancer centers, $122 a square foot, $220 a square foot. I mean, that's higher than most retail construction. That'll be higher than most commercial. Medical is usually most expensive, but these are most cases private, or in many cases nonprofit hospital clinics. but they've got to keep their costs down. They certainly have to be efficient in the services they provide.
Republican State Senator Joyce Kravitz also shared her concerns about new university construction projects that cost $460 per square foot.
I'm just staggered by the cost per square foot. And I somewhat agree with my colleague, Senator Ford. Walmart, Food Lion, you know, you build one, you know exactly what your cost is per square foot. There's a difference between what we want and what we need, just like your house. You can build a house at $100 a square foot, or you can build one at $350 a square foot. I can't see that we need different structures at every single building. I agree completely with Senator Ford. We should be able to design a plan. We shouldn't need to have 250 engineers for every project. We should design a building, whether it's a STEM building, engineering building, whatever it is, that's necessary but not necessarily what the university wants. There has to be a way to bring this cost down.
Johnson, the university construction expert, responded to the concerns.
We own, maintain, keep those buildings forever. We don't demolish our buildings. It's hard to demolish a building on campus. There's history there and there's culture there. And we just don't take buildings down. The investment that the people of North Carolina put in these buildings is a serious matter. And if we want to lower our building standards, we can certainly do that. We can build buildings for less money.
You've been listening to legislative pushback involving a recent report about new construction in the UNC system. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Full color throughout every issue. More visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read. A new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. No, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal, we hold government accountable to you. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. In the last decade or so, public charter schools have opened in many North Carolina communities. That's due in part to the state legislature, which has advanced pro-charter legislation and policies since Republicans were elected to legislative majorities in 2010. But the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research and Director of Education Studies is now cautioning the charter movement not to get complacent. Dr. Terry Stoops joins me now to explain why. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
You've actually written that you fear that the charter movement is much too comfortable for its own good. How so?
Well, it's grown significantly from 100 schools just around 5 years ago to 173 schools with 100,000 students and hundreds of millions of dollars going to the charter school movement. And yet there's very little representation at the North Carolina General Assembly and elsewhere advocating on behalf of charter schools. They've been fortunate to have a Republican majority in the General Assembly that sympathizes with charter schools and is trying to do things to help them out, but that might not always be the case.
In fact, politics, as we know, can swing back and forth. You can have one party in charge for a while, then voters will elect another party to a majority. So looking forward, you are essentially saying, look, be careful, because if those who oppose the idea of a public charter school are elected in sufficient numbers, they could roll things back?
That's right. Or they could at least put a pause on the growth that we have seen. They could say that for example, reimpose a cap on the number of charter schools. They can cap the number of students that existing charter schools can grow. They can do many things that would slow the rapid growth of charter schools down enough to try to disrupt the mass of students that are now attending North Carolina charter schools, mostly because they're dissatisfied with the district schools and they have options that they've never had before because charter schools are locating in areas where they hadn't previously. So we are seeing a growth of a charter school movement that was enabled by policies passed by Republicans that could easily be rolled back by, say, a Democratic majority in the General Assembly.
Terry, remind us of about how many kids in North Carolina have chosen a public charter school.
Well, this year, the charter schools have exceeded 100,000 students for the first time, and those aren't official figures yet. We'll get the official numbers at the end of the school year, but initial numbers tell us that over 100,000 students are attending charter schools, in 173 charter schools to be specific. Now, not every county has a charter school, and there are some areas of the state that could use a few more charter schools to serve those communities, but the growth has been outstanding, and the number of kids that are on the waiting lists for to get into these charter schools is probably around 30,000 at this point. So there's an incredible pent-up demand for charter schools that we're only now addressing.
Charters have always benefited from less regulation, less rules that they have to abide by in order to operate their schools. That's in exchange for more freedom. But are you concerned about regulations and that the traditional system might try to reel those schools back in under their control?
Well, absolutely. And we have seen some regulatory creep over the last few years of at least the idea being presented that charter schools need to do things like offer a subsidized school lunch or provide transportation. But I think that the one reform that I've been hearing over and over again that many charter school opponents really want to see happen is for school boards to take over charter schools, management of charter schools. So right now, charter schools are managed by a private nonprofit board. And the idea is to switch that governance model over to one where school boards, local school boards, manage charter school operations. It would basically transform them into district schools light. They wouldn't really have much of the autonomy that a charter school has now because of the way it's governed.
That's an interesting point because a school board, obviously, based on its makeup, has a certain approach to its public policy. So what would be the difference if that were to happen between a traditional school and a public charter school?
Well, I think that the one difference that we would see is the name of the school would be different and probably have charter in it. And the reason why that matters is because it is a selling point to parents. When they see that it's a charter school, they want to go to it. And this is the one thing that district schools have is a marketing problem. So this solves that problem by basically taking over the school. But the charter school movement, I think, is really in a poor position right now to beat back some of those potential regulations that might come in a sweeping election in 2018 that many analysts are predicting will occur.
Terry, right here in North Carolina, we are now seeing stories about Durham County Public Schools, and they have a new superintendent who is settling in. And this superintendent has been quoted as saying that he's going to be looking at how to improve Durham County's traditional public schools because a number of people have left the system, and some of them going to public charter schools. Is that an indication of what we've often heard from supporters of charters who say, look, not only will they be another option, but they're going to provide a little bit of competition for the traditional classroom?
Well, it only took 20 years for the district schools to recognize that, yes, charter schools are competition and they need to compete with the charter schools. We have seen a number of districts hire superintendents that at least understood the fact that parents do have a choice to go to a charter school, that they are competition, and that they need to compete with that charter school because they're losing their market share, and the more students they lose, the more money they lose. So they know that there's a problem that they need to address there. And so we've seen another wave of superintendents recognize that fact. Some have chosen to work with charter schools and adopt some charter school models. Others have noticed that they need to compete with charter schools, and some just grumble the fact that charter schools exist and wish on a falling star that they didn't.
Terry, remind us of how enrollment works at a public charter school, because, again, you will hear criticism that, well, charter schools that are doing well, they're doing well because they cherry-pick students. They get kids who are motivated, who have parents who are involved in their lives. How does it work? Do you just apply, or do they select people?
There's no cherry-picking that goes on. If the number of applicants exceeds the number of seats available, then they have to use a lottery. They have to choose the students at random. So they can't cherry-pick the students or decide to pick one student over another because of some demographic or other feature that the student has. They have to select them randomly. And this is an important point because they're always accused, charter schools are always accused of cherry-picking students, of just taking the cream of the crop and leaving the rest for district schools, when the reality is that a lot of charter schools in this state are serving low-income, low-performing children, and they do so by selecting them via a random method and not just picking and choosing who gets to go.
Lastly, Terry, let's talk about achievement of public charter schools. There is research on this. Is it fair to say it's mixed?
It is mixed. Charter schools, according to some research, are only performing as well as district schools. There's other research that suggests that they're performing better than district schools. But the argument is even if they're only working as well as a district school, parents still prefer them and they save money, and that in and of itself is a reason why we need to continue to support the charter school movement.
Well, it's a really interesting piece that Dr. Terry Stoops has written. You can find it at johnlock.org. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlock.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlock.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.